We are going to finish the first chapter of James today. We've been working our way through it. We've come to the end of chapter 1, actually just two verses today, verse 26 and 7. And we're going to take a break then for 4 weeks. Paul Taylor is going to lead us, I think Jake already mentioned this, in some messages for the 4 weeks of Advent, preparing us for the news of the Incarnation, Jesus born on Christmas Day. And then we'll return in January and take up the rest of this book, January and February. So we've come to sort of a break point, and one of the things that will occur, therefore, is we're going to spend some time sharing together this morning. We'll have a life together time in which we may have some questions that this text has raised for us, or some concerns we have, or request some help or prayer or whatever. But we're going to at least share together at this for some minutes when I'm done with this final text here, as a congregation, encourage one another. Last week, among the things we focused on was James' stirring concern that we not just listen only, people only with information, but be those who act upon what we've learned. He used the image of a person who fails to do so. It's like somebody who looks into a mirror, sees what's there, then turns away and forgets everything they've seen. He calls on us rather to be those who stare intently at what he calls the law of liberty, the good news of the gospel, the grace of Christ, see it clearly, be motivated to act, and find ourselves free as a result. The truth sets us free. We foolishly participate in our own deception. We're too comfortable, I think, and again, James is repeated in saying so. That we're too comfortable with knowledge absent obedience, with information that stays on the surface rather than penetrating. We are at home with knowing stuff that doesn't persuade us and produces no change. So the reminder is to be those who both hear and act. And a particular call to action is going to be in front of us in these final two verses. There's actually three big ideas, three challenges to us that I want to spend some time talking about. So let me read beginning in verse 26 of chapter 1 of James. If anyone considers himself religious yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Actually, the phrase to deceive oneself there is more graphic in Greek than it is in English, at least this translation. It says to lie to one's own heart. The one who has an image of himself or herself as a religious person, yet doesn't respond, as we'll see in a moment, with this reining in of the tongue, that person has lied to his or her own heart. And the claim to religion is worth nothing, is worthless. Verse 27. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So, what is the problem of an image of oneself as a religious person? Someone admired by others, someone who's, kept the rules, done the stuff, succeeded in accomplishments, religious accomplishments that are false. Well, this is the most ancient version of sort of fantasy, fooling oneself into believing what's not true about who you really are. Our son David is the commissioner of an 8-team fantasy football league. And I am the general manager of the Water Buffaloes in this league. That's my team. It turns out we're mired in fifth place at the moment, so I'm not too tempted to gain my identity from some fantasy environment. If I was in first place, it might be different, you know, to think of myself as some sort of NFL general manager, but in this case, I'm not so tempted by the fantasy environment to claim that as my identity. But it's easy to do, isn't it? We live in a world where we can play games in which we become the heroic person, the violent adversary, the romantic lead. We can enter virtual worlds and rig the thing so that we succeed at everything and draw avatars of ourselves that are beautiful because we don't look that way ourselves, but we create a persona that's completely attractive and invulnerable and always wins, and it's not true. And yet, if we're not careful, we prefer the fantasy version of ourselves to the real one. And the oldest way to attempt that fantasy self-image is to use religion. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. And it's true all throughout Scripture, where people will make claims of status and value and lives that please God and lives that are admired by others, and they are, in James' words, a lie to one's heart and are worthless. Jesus very often challenged his contemporaries on this exact point. Practicing righteousness before human beings, before men. Praying so that you're noticed. Praying in a loud voice on a public occasion so people notice how pious you are in your prayers. Fasting with your face filled with misery so people know for sure that you're fasting and give you credit for it. Being generous in giving, but waiting for the spotlight before any generosity occurs. Wearing special robes and sitting in special seats and calling for honorific titles and using the words of God and the things of God and the places of God to promote yourself and believing it yourself. And none of it's true. It's worthless. The word James uses here for religion is the word threskeia. And it has to do with all this kind of external performance of religious duties done for the show. We're just the same as those in the New Testament to whom Jesus spoke. We have insider lingo that we like to use to show off. We seek after status in the environments where Christians gather. We act in order to be noticed. And the question that is more important than any of these activities we're hoping will speak well of us is what's true on the inside. What do we actually do? And James offers a means by which we can test that. Do you rein in or bridle your tongue, your speech? That's one test. The other two that we'll look at now, these three in order: the reining in of the tongue, care for the poor, and a refusal to compromise. Are these true of us? What do we find if we examine ourselves in these terms? None of them need take place in public. Very often unnoticed, not gaudy, don't require a lot of learning. This question of what kind of person are we really may very well take place in kind of our own walk with God. No one else may know what's going on. It doesn't, as I said, require a high profile. But these are serious questions. They're important ones. The journey of self-discovery is an important journey. So what does James have in mind when he says that we should have a rein or a bridle? It's the word used of horses. And, the bit, bridle, reins, and so on for a horse. We should have a rein placed on our tongue. There's an old children's rhyme that goes this way: sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. That is completely untrue. that could not be more wrong-headed. It's an enduring little children's rhyme, but it gets it exactly wrong. Because the hurtful things that are said to us when we are most vulnerable, the bitter words, the rejection from people who are important to us, spoken to us in a harsh way, do more to destroy us than any broken bone ever will. Bones heal. Very often the spoken wounds may never heal or take a very long time to do so. Words are powerful. Our speech has enormous potential to both harm and do good. Words of blessing. When we speak love and encouragement and upbuilding to one another can have tremendous power to change the person for whom they are uttered. We have the power in what we say to do great harm and to do great good. And James says, bridle your tongue. Remember, we noted earlier in this chapter, he said, sometimes we run into the problem of just talking too much. We're supposed to be listening. And here we are, blathering on, quick to talk, 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 listen to ourselves all day long. And we don't take the time to be quiet enough to listen to important things. And having listened to important things, speak a good word in season, in the right way, at the right time. Courage articulated, love, blessing spoken. Those of you who are married in this room will remember your wedding day, I think, well remember. The oath you made. Before God and these witnesses, do you now promise your life to her, her life to you, his life to you, your life to him? And a statement is made and the world changes and you are a different person for the rest of your life. The power of speech is immense. And if we do not have any control over what we say, if there are violent outbursts, if there is defensiveness, every time someone says something that puts us in a light we don't like, we have to interject all the time and speak up. No, wait, 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 stop here. No, let me explain myself. Let me make sure that nothing said that I don't approve of about me and the love of gossip. Are we those who easily fall into the kind of deliciousness of gossiping about other folks? Angry outbursts. The test being offered us here is about who we are. And let me read to you Jesus' words in Matthew 12, because I think this makes James' instruction even more powerful, this reality. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good man, the good person, brings good things out of the good stored up in him. The evil one brings evil things out of the evil stored up in him. We cannot bridle our tongues, our speech. We cannot control our speech if our hearts have stored up within them anger, deception, self-righteousness, blasphemy. If we have all of those stored up inside us, we are going to speak what's true. And if we have stored up in us gratitude and grace and the love of God and freedom, then our speech is going to reflect what's on the inside. So when James says, bridle your tongue, what he's saying is deal with your heart. That in the long run, the very effort to become someone who speaks in loving terms means that I have to face what's true of me on the inside. And I need to discover and invite in this presence of the Spirit of God who can clean out the old storehouse and begin storing within me the truths of God and the grace of God received by me so I have it to offer to others. The second test that we can draw from these verses, the second challenge, the second question we ask ourselves has to do with orphans and widows, which is another way of asking our concern for the poor. In the first century, times were not as they are now when a great many places among us, women have their own fortune, their own money, their own jobs, their own own property, and so on. In biblical times, orphans and widows were essentially the definition of the unprotected, of the vulnerable, of those who were likely to be poor, and if they were not poor, they could not defend themselves against those who would take advantage of them. And so, the question arises, what is our response to those who are in need? Those who are defenseless, those who are poor. Psalm 68:5 reads this way. A father to the fatherless, a defender of the widows, is God in his holy dwelling. The one who becomes the husband or the father or the uncle or the brother, that becomes the male defender, the defender who has the status to act on behalf of the needy, the one who takes up that role is God. He becomes the father to the fatherless. He becomes the companion of the widow. And James says that God is our father, and if this is his concern, a couple of observations flow from this. First, are we concerned about the things that concern God? If we are his children, we should be shaped by his heart. What matters to him should matter to us. The child should grow up to go into the family business, if you will. If my father has these concerns, I ought to be to take up those myself. I ought to go where he would go and act as he acts and get involved in the things that matter to him. I think the second point that flows from the statement that God is our father and he is the father of the fatherless and so on, is that we're not so different from those who are vulnerable and weak and poor. He stands as father to them. He stands as father to us. That means we're the same. And even on those occasions when we think we can take care of ourselves and we got everything, got the world by the tail and we know exactly what we're doing, we are in fact no different from the neediest among us. There's no substantial difference. And so we learn to express the care our Father has for those in need, and we learn to see ourselves as those who are also in need. The rendering in the NIV of verse 27 says that religion that is pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress. The actual term there is to visit widows and orphans in their distress. And I think the point perhaps to that, if we think about it for a moment, is that it's easy and not difficult in some sense to be concerned about the poor generically, to have as a category, I am concerned for poor people. But it's all different. It's a whole different thing to actually visit them, to know some by name, to know where they live, to be in the place where they make their life and have their experience, to walk into the home of someone who's broken and frightened and hurting and feel welcome there and at home there, and the reverse, to have them be welcome in our homes, to have a relationship that's two ways, that's real. It's not a theoretical thing where I'm writing a letter to the editor out of my concern for the poor. I'm actually getting involved in some way, hands-on in some way. Jesus used the same, or Matthew's gospel uses the exact same word for visit in the context of these verses. Jesus has commended the sheep at the end of the age, and they say to him, when did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. Go to visit the sick and the imprisoned and the poor and the needy, and having done so, find ourselves in the company of Christ. So James wants us concerned for the poor, but he wants us concerned for the heart, not and those who weep with those who weep, those who will bring a meal at Thanksgiving because that's important, but it's not the only thing that's important, that we know their distress. We visit them in their distress. We understand the particular pain, this widow's tears, this orphan's sorrow, this needy one's loss. We know them, we understand them, we visit them in their distress, we care about them. And this is a question of whether we are really those whose lives are as we claim them to be. We are God's people. And yet perhaps the claim is false, and perhaps we'll learn something by examining ourselves. The third of these challenges is to keep oneself unpolluted by the world. That phrase has to do with compromise of some important value, some important conviction, some important calling that we have. There have been times, and it's not too far or unfamiliar to us, when it seems as if Christians are concerned about stuff that really doesn't matter. It's sort of like having good table manners or being fastidious about your etiquette and worrying about being those who might laugh at a crude joke or might have ruffian friends or something, and we're trying to be unpolluted in some kind of silly or shallow sense. That's not the point James is making. He's talking about compromise of what our convictions are, what we stand for, being those who have sort of a mixture of worldly motives and godly motives. Think about every reform movement that we can remember, whether it's political reform or a company that has a new CEO that's going to come in and fix things up, or the team has got a new coach and he's going to come change the culture. Always the reformers come in and say, well, there's just way too much sloppiness and weakness and compromise, and you know, the folks that were elected before us, they took lobbyist money and they were on the payroll and they were a bunch of inside the beltway, you know, hard of hearing, don't care for the people. They've lost their what they stand for. We're going to do it different. This time it'll be different. We're going to come in with pure motives for the right reasons, do the right thing. You know, the coach that takes over the team. Oh, look at all the lousy attitudes and the softness, and they're not tough anymore. They're not focused anymore. They used to be something. Now they're not. I'm going to come in and fix things. And at the end of the day, the reformer becomes the one on the take. The one with the broom that's going to sweep clean eventually settles in and starts compromising his or her principles, loves the perks, likes the adulation, sells out for exactly the same reasons that the group before sold out. And that's what James is saying. Don't be polluted by the world. Don't give up important things for the advantages that the world has to offer, for the payoff that the world has to offer. And I think the only way we can hope to resist that sort of compromise is to be grateful. The alternative to the world's seduction, that must be an important point. I don't know what it was I was going to make. That's likely to be important, whatever that was. The alternative to the world's seductions is gratitude, is renewed thankfulness to God for what he's done for us. It's saying again and again and over again in clearer terms, Lord, I don't deserve anything I have. I am so grateful for what I have. And we are renewed in our willingness to trust him if we are renewed in our gratitude to him. It's not possible to love widows and orphans and care about the needy and get involved in real life and go work among the folks God loves without dealing with hard things. But we don't have to be seduced by them. And I think that's James' call here. Well, chapter 1, which we now have concluded, three verses, 16, 22, and 26, calls out against being deceived. It's actually different words, translated the same in English, at least in the NIV, but it is clearly a burden of James, using various ways in various parts of his argument, coming at it from various directions, that the people he pastors not live with some sort of false version of things, not be at home with lies and looking at the mirror and turning away and not seeing what we really are and making assumptions about ourselves that aren't true. We shouldn't be those who pray with a double mind or blame God for the manipulations of our own flesh, ignoring his outstretched hand, preferring the sound of our voice to words of truth. We shouldn't be those who lie to their own hearts about who we are. And knowing those things, we will ask ourselves, what's true of me? What's true of us? And then we're set on the journey of change, of crying out to the Savior who can change us, of longing to be different, being eager to grow amongst others who have the same eagerness. And that's why we need to share some together, why we need to hear from one another, why we need to tell stories and ask questions and enter into prayer for one another and give counsel and cry out when we're hurting. And we're going to spend some time doing that and begin with Dan Van Eldren. Dan is a deacon in this church.